September in the White Mountains is the cruelest month. The gaunt hotels, vestiges of Victorian tradition, are shuttered. Motels and overnight cabins flash their neon vacancy signs for only a few fitful hours before their owners give up and retire early. The New Hampshire ski slopes are barren of snow, the trails appearing as great brownish gashes beside the silent tramways and chairlifts. The Labor Day exodus has swept most of the roads clear of traffic. It was in the doleful mid-September period of 1961, September 19th to be exact, that Barney Hill and his wife Betty began their drive from the Canadian border down US 3 through the White Mountains on their way home to Portsmouth. It was to be a night drive brought on by a sense of urgency. The radio of their 1957 Chevrolet Bel Air hardtop made it clear that a hurricane coming up the coast might cut in toward New Hampshire. They had failed to bring along enough cash to cover all the extras of their holiday trip, and their funds had dwindled sharply as they had driven leisurely up to Niagara Falls, then circled back through Montreal toward home. They had cleared through the U.S.-Canadian Customs House at about 9 that evening, winding along the lonely ceiling of Vermont's Northeast Kingdom. The traffic was sparse. Few other cars appeared on the road before the hills approached the welcome lights of Colebrook a half hour later. A forlorn glow came from the windows of a single restaurant, and realizing that this might be the last chance for any refreshment for the rest of the trip, they decided to turn back even though they had driven past it. The restaurant was nearly deserted. Only one woman, the waitress in the quiet restaurant, seemed to show any reaction at all to the fact that Betty and Barney Hills was a mixed marriage. Barney, a strikingly handsome descendant of a proud Ethiopian freeman whose great-grandmother was born during slavery, but raised in the house of a plantation owner because she was his own daughter. Betty, whose family bought three tracts of land in York, Maine in 1637, only to have one member cut down by Indians. Regardless of what attention their mixed marriage drew in public places, they were no longer self-conscious about it. Their first attraction to each other, one that still remained, was of intellect and mutual interests. Together they stumped the state of New Hampshire speaking for the cause of civil rights. But what was to happen to them this night of September the 19th, 1961, had nothing whatever to do with their successful mixed marriage or their dedication to social progress. Nor was there any hint of what was to happen as they sat at the restaurant counter in Colebrook, Barney unceremoniously eating a hamburger, Betty a piece of chocolate layer cake. They didn't linger too long at the counter, just long enough for a cigarette and a cup of black coffee before they continued down US 3 toward home. The distance from Colebrook to Portsmouth is 170 miles, with US 3 remarkably smooth and navigable in the face of the deep mountain gorges it must negotiate. The clock over the restroom in the Colebrook restaurant read 10:05 when they left that night. "It looks," Barney had said to Betty as they got in their car, "like we should be home by 2:30 in the morning, or 3 at the latest." Betty agreed. She had confidence in Barney's driving, even though she sometimes goaded him for pushing too fast. It was a bright, clear night with an almost full moon. The stars were brilliant, as they always are in the New Hampshire mountains on a cloudless night, when starshine seems to illuminate the tops of the peaks with a strange incandescence. The car was running smoothly through the night air, the road winding effortlessly along the flat ground of the uppermost Connecticut River Valley, an ancient Indian and lumbering country, rich in history and legend. Betty, an inveterate sightseer, enjoyed the brilliance of the moon reflecting on the valley and the mountains in the distance, both in New Hampshire to the east and over the river to Vermont in the west. Delcy, the hill's scrappy little dachshund, was at peace on the floor by the front seat at Betty's feet. To the left of the moon, and slightly below it, was a particularly bright star, perhaps a planet, Betty Hill thought, because of its steady glow. Just south of Lancaster, the exact time she cannot remember, Betty was a little startled to notice that another star or planet, a bigger one, had appeared above the other. It had not been there, she was sure, when she looked before. But more curious was that the new celestial visitor clearly appeared to be getting bigger and brighter. For several moments she watched it, said nothing to her husband as he negotiated the driving through the mountains. Finally, when the strange light persisted, she nudged Barney, who slowed the car somewhat and looked out to the right-hand side of the windshield to see it. "When I looked at it first," Barney Hill later said, "didn't seem anything particularly unusual, except we were fortunate enough to see a satellite." They drove on, glancing at the bright object frequently, finding it difficult to tell if the light itself were moving, or if the movement of the car were making it seem to move. The object would disappear behind trees or a mountaintop, then reappear again as the obstruction was cleared. Delcy, the dog, was beginning to get slightly restless, and Betty mentioned that perhaps they should let her out and take advantage of the road stop to get a better look. Barney, an avid plane watcher who sometimes liked to take his two sons from a former marriage to watch Piper Cub seaplanes land and take off on Lake Winnipesaukee, agreed, and pulled the car over to the side of the road where there was reasonably unobstructed visibility. There were woods nearby, and Barney, a worrier at times, mentioned that they might keep an eye out for bears, a distinct possibility in this part of the country. Betty, who seldom let herself get concerned or emotional about anything, laughed his suggestion off, snapped the chain lead on Delcy's collar, and walked her along the side of the road. At this moment, she noticed that the star, or the light, or whatever it was in the September sky, was definitely moving. As Barney joined her on the road, she handed Delcy's leash to him and went back to the car. She took from the front seat a pair of 7x50 crescent binoculars they had brought along for their holiday scenery. Barney, noting that the light in the sky was moving, was now fully convinced that it was a straying satellite. Betty put the binoculars up to her eyes and focused carefully. What they both were about to see was to change their lives forever. The holiday trip had been a spontaneous idea, originating with Barney. For some time now, he had been assigned to the night shift at the Boston Post Office, where he worked as an assistant dispatcher. He liked the job, if not the hours and the long commuting drive from Portsmouth to Boston each night, 60 miles each way. The commuting was especially exhausting. With no train or bus available, at the late night hour he began work. The rigors of the daily 120-mile round trip had, Barney felt, been instrumental in causing his ulcer to kick up, a condition for which he was under medical treatment. He began thinking about the idea for the trip while he was driving into work on the evening of September the 14th, 1961. Betty had a week's vacation coming up, a badly needed one from her job as a child welfare worker for the state, handling a rather overwhelming caseload of 120 assignments at one time. With luck, Barney would be able to take some of his vacation leave and relieve some of the pressure while waiting for the results of some recent x-rays of his ulcer his doctor had taken. All during that night at work, the idea appealed to him more. It grew on him as he went through his usual routine, standing in front of some 40 clerks sorting mail, calling out numbers of towns or sections of the city of Boston. Barney, with an IQ of nearly 140, could handle more complex jobs than this, but like so many post office workers, he found the frustration of routine work compensated for by the civil service advantages. Further, the steadiness of the job gave him ample time for his community service work, which he felt was both demanding and rewarding. He punched out of the Boston Post Office at 7:30 the following morning and drove towards Portsmouth in anticipation of surprising Betty. They planned their trip that morning over a cup of hot coffee, Betty accepting the idea at once. But trip money was not in the budget. Barney's main regret was that his two sons couldn't join them, for they both had made a pleasing adjustment to the second marriage, with mutual affection springing up spontaneously between boys and Betty. Betty's experience with colored people had been limited. Not too many lived in New Hampshire, but at an early age, she lived across the street from an interracial couple and absorbed the snide remarks of her classmates against the colored wife. Later, Betty's mother impressed her by saying that although some people did not like colored people, this was wrong because they were people just like everyone else. If Betty heard anyone talking against them, she should speak up without hesitation. She did. When she was a sophomore at the University of New Hampshire, which Betty entered in 1937, a girl who was a Negro from Wilmington, Delaware, enrolled at the college, to the consternation of both the administration and the students. In the late 30s, integration was a problem even in the northern state universities. Betty would find Anne alone in the corner of the smoking room, ignored by the other students. Betty would say nothing at the time, but seethed underneath. When Anne would leave, the other girls would suggest caustically that Anne should go back where she came from, and Betty would react strongly. On one such occasion, as Anne was leaving the smoking room, Betty went to her, and in front of the others, asked to see her room. It was the beginning of acceptance for Anne, but not until after a long struggle. At times, Betty would almost physically restrain her from leaving the university. She fought with Anne to stop her from packing her luggage. Eventually, Anne graduated Phi Beta Kappa, went on to Harvard, and taught on the faculty of a southern college. Although the roots of Betty Hill's marriage to Barney may have grown in the attitude expressed by this incident, their problems as an interracial couple were minimal. Barney, at times, showed concern about rejection in public places, hotels, restaurants, or meetings. But in their private social life, they were popular, accepted, and almost overactive. The planning of the trip that was to have such a profound impact on their lives was brief and relaxed. The shortage of immediate funds was partially compensated for by Betty's idea of borrowing a car refrigerator from a friend. In this way, the expense of too many meals in restaurants would be reduced. Barney, momentarily ignoring the diet for his ulcers, drank a glass of orange juice, ate 6 strips of bacon and 2 soft-boiled eggs as he plotted the course of the trip on a few Gulf road maps. They would drive leisurely, avoiding the throughways, pay a brief visit to Niagara Falls, then circle through Montreal and back to Portsmouth. It was a clear, crisp New Hampshire morning as they drove out Route 4 toward Concord in a festive mood. Barney, at the wheel, burst into a hoarse version of, "Oh, what a beautiful morning!" Betty, who liked to hear Barney sing, smiled. Barney, who liked to please Betty, smiled back. There was no hint at all of what was about to happen later, nor could there be. No such event would be so thoroughly documented. The object they saw in the sky near Route 3 4 nights later, south of Lancaster, New Hampshire, continued its unpredictable movement as they passed through Whitfield and the village of Twin Mountains. They stopped briefly several times, and by now Barney was frankly puzzled. His only alternate theory, aside from that of a satellite, was that the object was a star, a theory he immediately discounted because they had proved that it was in movement, changing its course in an erratic manner. At one of the stops, a few miles north of Cannon Mountain, Betty had said, "Barney, if you think that's a satellite or a star, you're being absolutely ridiculous." With his naked eye, Barney could tell that she was right. It was obviously not a celestial object now, he was sure. "We've made a mistake, Betty," he said. "It's a commercial plane, probably on its way to Canada." He got back in the car, and they continued driving on. Betty, in the passenger seat, kept it in view as they moved down Route 3. It seemed to her that it was getting bigger and brighter, and she kept getting more puzzled and more curious. The road was completely deserted. They hadn't seen a car or truck in either direction for miles now, which left them alone in the deep gorges late at night. Some natives of northern New Hampshire prefer never to drive through these roads at night, through long-standing custom and superstition. In winter, an informal group known as the Blue Angels patrols the roads for cars frozen or broken down. It is too easy to freeze to death in these lonely stretches, and the state troopers cannot possibly cover the wide territory frequently enough. Barney, his concern growing in spite of his comforting theories, hoped that he would soon see a trooper or at least another car driving by which he could flag and compare notes with. Around 11 o'clock, they approached the enormous and somber silhouette of Cannon Mountain, looming to the west on their right. Barney slowed the car down near a picnic turnout that commanded a wide view to the west and looked again at the strange moving light. In amazement, he noted that it swung suddenly from its northern flight pattern, turning to the west, then completing its turn and heading back directly toward them. Barney braked the car sharply, turning off into the picnic area. "Whatever you're calling it, Barney," Betty said, "I don't know why, because it's still up there, and it's still following us, and if anything, it's coming right toward us." "It's gotta be a plane," Barney said. They were standing in the picnic area now, looking up at the light, which was growing bigger still. "A commercial liner." "With a crazy course like that," Betty said. "Well, then it's a Piper Cub, that's what it is, with some hunters who might be lost." "It's not the hunting season," Betty said, as Barney took the binoculars from her. "And I don't hear a sound." Neither did Barney, although he desperately wanted to. "It might be a helicopter," he said as he looked through the binoculars. He was sure that it wasn't, but was reaching for any kind of explanation which would make sense. "The wind might be carrying the sound in the other direction." "There is no wind, Barney. Not tonight. You know that." Through the binoculars, Barney now made out a shape like the fuselage of a plane, although he could see no wings. There also seemed to be a blinking series of lights along the fuselage, or whatever it was, in an alternating pattern. When Betty took the glasses, the object passed in front of the moon in silhouette. It appeared to be flashing thin pencils of different colored lights, rotating around an object which at that time appeared cigar-shaped. Just a moment before, it had changed its speed from slow to fast, then slowed down again as it crossed the face of the moon. The lights were flashing persistently, red, amber, green, and blue. She turned to Barney, asking him to take another look. "It's got to be a plane," Barney said. "Maybe a military plane." He was getting irritated at Betty now, or taking out his irritation on her, because she was refusing to accept a natural explanation. At one time, several years before, in 1957, Betty's sister and family had described seeing clearly an unidentified flying object in Kingston, New Hampshire, where they lived. Betty, who had confidence in her sister's reliability and capacity for observation, believed the story of her sighting. Barney neither believed nor disbelieved. He was indifferent to the subject as a whole, had little interest in it. If anything, he was more skeptical of flying objects after hearing her story. He felt that Betty, for the first time in 5 years, was about to bring this subject up again, but she didn't mention it. Beside them, the dachshund was whining and cowering. Betty gave the binoculars to Barney, took Delcy to the car and got in and shut the door. Barney put the glasses on the object again, again wishing that he could find some comfort from comparing notes with a passing motorist. For the first time, he felt he was being observed, that the object was actually coming closer and attempting to circle them. If it's a military craft, he was thinking, it should not do this. And his mind went back to a time a few years before when a jet had buzzed close to him, shattered the sound barrier, and cracked the air with an explosion. Getting back in the car, Barney mentioned to Betty that he thought the craft had seen them and was playing games with them. He tried not to let Betty know that he was afraid, something he didn't like to admit to himself. They drove on toward Cannon Mountain at not much more than 5 miles an hour, catching glimpses of the object as it moved erratically in the sky. At the top of the mountain, the only light they had seen for miles glowed like a beacon, appearing to be on top of the closed and silent aerial tramway, or perhaps on the restaurant there. They stopped again near the base of the mountain momentarily, as the object suddenly swung behind the dark silhouette and disappeared. At the same moment, the light on the top of the mountain went out, inexplicably. As the car moved by the darkened silhouette of the old man of the mountain, the object appeared again, gliding silently, leisurely, parallel to the car to the west of them, on the Vermont side of the car. It was more wooded here, more difficult to keep the object in sight as it glided behind the trees. But it was there, moving with them. Near the turnoff for the flume, a tourist attraction, they stopped again. Almost got a sharp, clear look at it, but again the trees intervened. Just beyond the flume, they passed a small motel, the first sign of life they'd seen for many miles. The tidy hostelry looked comforting, although Barney, his eyes alternately moving between the curves of the road and the object in the sky, barely noticed it. Betty noted a sign, beaming with AAA approval, and the light in a single lonely window. A man was standing in the doorway of one of the cottages, and Betty thought how easy it would be to end the whole situation right now by simply pulling into the motel. She was thinking this, but she didn't say anything to Barney. Her curiosity about the object had now become overwhelming, and she was determined to see more of it. By now, Barney was beginning to irritate her by trying to deny the existence of the object. It was now apparently only a few hundred feet high, and it was huge. Further off, it had seemed to Betty that it was spinning. Now it had stopped, and the light pattern had changed from blinking multicolored lights to a steady white glow. In spite of the vibrations of the car, she put the binoculars to her eyes and looked again. She drew a quick, involuntary breath because she could clearly see a double row of windows. Without the glasses, it had appeared only as a streak of light. Now it was clear that this was a structured craft of enormous dimension. Just how large she couldn't tell because both distance and altitude were hard to judge exactly. Then, slowly, a red light came out on the left side of the object, followed by a similar one on the right. "Barney," she said, "Barney, you've got to stop. You've never seen anything like this in your life." He looked through the windshield and could see it plainly now, not more than 200 feet in the air, he thought, and coming closer. A curve to the left in the road now shifted the object to the right of the car, but the distance remained the same. To the right, not far south of Indian Head, where another historic stone face surveys the mountains and valleys, he saw two imitation commercial wigwams on the site of a closed-down enterprise known as Natureland. Here, hundreds of youngsters swarm with their parents during summer visits. At this moment, It was silent and tomb-like. Barney stopped the car almost in the center of the road, forgetting in the excitement any problem with other traffic. "All right, give me the binoculars," he said. Betty resented his tone. It sounded as if he were trying to humor her. Barney got out, the motor still running, and leaned his arm on the door of the car. By now, the object had swung toward them and hovered silently in the air not more than a short city block away, not more than two treetops high. It was raked on an angle, and its full shape was apparent for the first time, that of a large, glowing pancake. But the vibrations from the motor jostled his arm, blurring his vision. He stepped to one side of the car to get a better look. "Do you see it? Do you see it?" Betty said. For the first time, her voice was rising in emotion. Barney, he admitted frankly later, was scared, perhaps as much because Betty rarely became excited as because of the nearness of this strange and utterly silent object, defying almost any law of aerodynamics. "It's just a plane or something," he snapped at her. "Okay," Betty said. "It's a plane. But did you ever see a plane with two red lights? I always thought planes had one red and one green light." "Well, I can't get a good look at it," he said. The car was shaking the binoculars. Then he stepped a few feet away and looked again. As he did so, the huge object, as wide in diameter as the distance between three telephone poles along the road, Barney later described it, swung in a silent arc directly across the road, not more than 100 feet from him. The double row of windows was now clear and obvious. Barney was fully gripped with fear now, but for a reason that he cannot yet explain, he found himself moving across the road on the driver's side of the car, onto the field and across the field, directly toward it. Now the enormous disc was raked on an angle toward him. Two fin-like projections on either side were now sliding out further, each with a red light on it. The windows curved around the craft, around the perimeter of the thick pancake-like disc, glowing with brilliant white light. There was still no sound. Shaken, but still finding an irresistible impulse to move closer to the craft, he continued on across the field, coming within 50 feet of it as it dropped down to the height of a single tall tree. He did not estimate its size in feet, except that he knew it was as big or bigger in diameter than the length of a jet airliner. Back in the car, Betty was not at first aware that Barney was walking away from her. She was thinking that this wasn't a very smart place to park the car in the middle of the highway, even though there were no curves nearby. The car was neither on the right nor the left. It was splitting the white dotted line down the middle of the road. She would watch, she thought, to see if any headlights appeared either in front of or to the rear of the car, and at least pull the car quickly out of the way if another should appear on the road. She busied herself doing this for several moments, and then suddenly became aware that Barney had disappeared into the blackness of the field. Instinctively, she called for him. "Barney," she screamed. "Barney, you damn fool, come back here." There was no answer, and she started to slide across the front seat toward the open door on the driver's side of the car. Out on the field, near a shuttered vegetable stand and a single gnarled apple tree, Barney put the binoculars up to his eyes. Then he stopped, very still. Behind the clearly structured windows, he could see the figures, at least half a dozen living beings. They seemed to be bracing themselves against the transparent windows as the craft tilted down toward his direction. They were, as a group, staring directly at him. He became vaguely aware that they were wearing uniforms. Betty, now nearly 200 feet away, was screaming at him from the car, but Barney has no recollection of hearing this. The binoculars seemed glued to his eyes. Then, on some invisible, inaudible signal, every member of the crew stepped back from the window toward a large panel a few feet behind the window line. Only one remained there looking at him, apparently a leader. In the binoculars, Barney could see appendages in action among the apparent crew at what seemed to be a control board behind the windows of the craft. Slowly, the craft descended lower, a few feet at a time. As the fins bearing the two red lights spread out further on the sides of the craft, an extension lowered from the underside, perhaps a ladder, he could not be sure. He sharpened the focus of the binoculars on the one face remaining at the window. His memory at this point is blurred. For a reason he cannot explain, he was certain that he was about to be captured. He tried to pull the glasses away from his eyes, to turn away, but he couldn't. He remembers the eyes of the one crew member who stared down at him. Barney had never seen eyes like that before. With all his energy, he ripped the binoculars from his eyes and ran screaming back across the field to Betty in the car. He tossed the binoculars on the seat, barely missing Betty, who had just straightened up from getting ready to slide out of his side of the car as she heard him running across the hard surface of the road. Barney was near hysteria. He jammed the car into first gear, spurted off down the road, shouting he was sure they were going to be captured. He ordered Betty to look out the window to see where the craft was. She rolled down the window on the passenger side, looked out. The object was nowhere in sight. Craning her neck, she looked directly above the car. She could see nothing, whatever. The strange craft did not appear in sight. But neither were the stars, which had seconds ago been so brilliant in the sky. Barney kept yelling he was sure it had swung above them. Betty checked again, but all she could see was total darkness. She looked out the rear window, saw nothing except the stars then visible through the window. Then, suddenly, a strange electronic-sounding beeping was heard. The car seemed to vibrate with it. It was in regular rhythm, beep, 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 seeming to come from behind the car in the direction of the trunk. Barney said, "What's that noise?" Betty said, "I don't know." They each began to feel an odd, tingling drowsiness come over them. From that moment, a sort of haze came over them. Sometime later, how long they were not sure, the beeping sound repeated itself. They were conscious only that there were two sets of these beeps separated by a time span they had no idea about, as well as what had happened or how long it had taken. As the second set of beeps grew louder, the hill's awareness slowly returned. They were still in the car, and the car was moving with Barney at the wheel. They were silent, numb, and somnambulistic. At first, they rode silently, glancing out at the road to see just where they might be. A sign told them that they were somewhere in the vicinity of Ashland, 35 miles south of Indian Head, where the inexplicable beeping had first sounded. In those first few moments of consciousness, Betty remembers faintly saying to her husband, "Now do you believe in flying saucers?" And he recalls answering, "Don't be ridiculous, of course not." But neither can remember much detail other than this, until they had driven onto the new thruway, U.S. 93. Not long after entering this highway, Betty suddenly snapped out of her semi-wakefulness and pointed to a sign reading Concord, 17 miles. "That's where we are, Barney," she said. "Now we know." Barney, too, remembers his mind clearing at this point. He does not even recall being disturbed or concerned about the 35 miles between Indian Head and Ashland, about which he seemed to remember nothing. They drove on toward Concord, saying little. They did decide, though, that the experience at Indian Head was so strange, so unbelievable, that they would tell no one about it. "No one would believe it anyway," Barney said. "I find it hard to believe myself." Betty agreed. Just outside of Portsmouth, they noticed dawn streaking the sky in the east, and it was nearly full daylight when they reached home. Barney looked at his watch, but it had stopped running, and shortly afterwards Betty looked at hers, which had also stopped. Inside, the kitchen clock read shortly after 5 a.m. "It looks," said Barney, "like we've arrived home a little later than expected." Betty took Delcy out on her chain for a morning airing while Barney unloaded the car. They said little. For a reason she couldn't pinpoint, Betty asked him to put the luggage in the back hall instead of having it in the house. He complied, then went to clear out the rest of the car. Picking up the binoculars, he noticed for the first time an unusual thing. The leather strap that had been around his neck the night before was freshly and cleanly broken in half. From Concord on down, during the silent drive, both Betty and Barney had looked to the sky at regular intervals, wondering if the strange object would appear again. Even after they went into the house, a red frame structure on a small plot in Portsmouth, they found themselves occasionally going to the windows to look up at the morning sky. Both had a strange, clammy feeling. They sat down at the kitchen table for a cup of coffee, but not before Barney went into the bathroom to examine his lower abdomen, which for a reason he could not explain was bothering him. After he came out of the bathroom, they reviewed what had happened and again resolved not to discuss it with anyone. The latter part of the trip was extremely vague. They couldn't remember much of anything about the drive from Indian Head to Ashland. But both recalled very faintly a large, luminous moon shape, which seemed to be touching the road, sitting on one end under some pines. Betty, straining to remember, thought that Barney had made a sharp left turn from Route 3, but could not in any way identify where this might have been. When they had seen the moon-shaped object, Barney faintly recalled saying to Betty, "Oh, no, not again." Both agree they regained full consciousness at the sign on U.S. 93, which indicated it was 17 miles to Concord. They collapsed into bed immediately after a breakfast snack, and their sleep was undisturbed. It was nearly 3 that afternoon when they woke up. Barney, lying in bed with his eyes opened, again began recalling the strange experience of the night before. He still had the feeling that there was a presence around somewhere, a vague and totally indefinable presence. The figures he had seen aboard the craft he shunted quickly out of his mind. As Betty awakened, the thoughts of what had happened the night before crowded everything else out of her mind. She could not think beyond that trip home and the experience they had had. She was to go around the rest of the day, shaking her head in disbelief. One of her first acts that afternoon on arising, why, she never fully knew, was to take the dress and shoes she had worn during the night before and pack them in the back of her closet. She has never worn them since. Barney went over to the clothes he had worn the night before and was a little startled to discover that his best shoes were severely scuffed along their shiny tops. Barney could not understand why it was the tops of his shoes that were so badly scuffed. He finally assumed that somewhere in that field he had dragged the tops of his feet along some rocks. Later, he was to discover the possible cause. The sudden recollection of the incident at the field near Indian Head prompted him to go to the back door and look at the sky again. He was expecting something, but he didn't know what it was. Their resolution to keep the experience absolutely quiet began to waver during their afternoon breakfast session that day. Barney was trying to hold out completely, but Betty, in the light of her sister's experience with a UFO several years before, wanted to share it with her, at least. Betty went to the phone and called her sister Janet Miller, who lived in nearby Kingston with her husband and children. Betty recounted the story of the night before. Janet, who had no reservations about the possibility of a UFO sighting because of her own experience, grew very excited and confirmed Betty's growing feeling that the car or their clothes might have in some way been exposed to radiation if the object had hovered directly over the car. Any ordinary compass might show evidence of radiation if the needle became seriously disturbed on contact with the car's surface. Barney got the compass for his wife. She rushed outside and found it raining. She ran the compass along the wet side of the car. The needle did not react to any appreciable extent, but as she drew it near the trunk of the car, her attention was drawn to an unusual sight. A dozen or more shiny circles scattered on the surface of the trunk, each perfectly circular and about the size of a silver dollar. They were highly polished in contrast to the dimmer surface of the rest of the trunk. She recalled at this point that the strange beeping sounds they had heard the night before came from the direction of the trunk, and she was startled by the sight of the round, shiny spots in this vicinity. Carefully, she placed the compass on one of the spots. The needle immediately began wavering. She almost panicked, but got control of herself and placed the compass on the other side of the car, where none of the shiny spots appeared. The needle reacted normally, remaining pointed in one direction. Quickly, she shifted the compass back to the shiny spot. Again, the needle went out of control. She ran quickly back to the house. "Barney," she said, "you've got to come outside and look at this with me. There are these bright, shiny spots all over the trunk of the car, and the compass spins every time I put it anywhere near them." Barney insisted that it was her imagination and didn't want to go out in the rain. In the meanwhile, a couple renting an apartment from the hills in the second floor of their house dropped down, and noting that Betty was getting quite upset about something, asked what the matter was. Betty spilled out the story of the UFO sighting to them and told them that she wanted Barney to go out and look at the strange spots and the reaction of the compass. Barney then reluctantly went out with the other couple while Betty called her sister to report the findings. Janet, in the meanwhile, had talked to the former chief of police of Newton, New Hampshire, and he had immediately suggested the Hills notify the Peace Air Force Base in Portsmouth, a strategic Air Force command installation that had been the recipient of a steady number of UFO reports in New Hampshire in recent months. Barney came back into the living room within a few minutes, just before Betty hung up. "How did the compass act for you?" she asked. "Just like any compass," he said. Betty eyed him coldly. "Well, why did it jump around when you touched it to the trunk?" "I don't know." "What about the shiny spots?" Betty said. "Did you see those?" "Yes," said Barney. "Well, what about them?" "Oh, probably something dropped on the trunk." Betty was convinced he was simply denying this experience to himself, and she didn't know why. Later, Barney explained that the experience had been such a nightmare to him that he wanted desperately to put the whole thing behind him. He urged her to forget it when she insisted on following Janet's advice to call the Peace Air Force Base. "All right," he finally agreed, "but if you do call the Air Force Base, leave me out of it." Betty was haunted by the thought that they might have been exposed to radioactivity, but at the same time she realized that this might sound ridiculous to the officers at the Air Force Base. However, she called the air police at the base, and after several transfers by the switchboard, she finally found one officer who asked her for the details. She gave him the facts in bare outline because the officer's attitude was cynical and uncommunicative. Out of embarrassment or shyness, she skipped the details of seeing the double row of windows, feeling that this might make her the target for further cynicism. She did, however, report the fins apparently separating at the sides of the craft, with two red lights on either side. The officer grew more interested in this, and when Betty explained that her husband had a better look at this part of the craft than she did, the officer asked to speak with Barney. Barney was extremely reluctant to come to the phone, but he had simmered down a little by now and finally agreed. He cooperated in giving out as many details as he could remember, but he sheepishly avoided mentioning the figures he had clearly observed on the craft. At one moment, the officer told Barney that he was cutting him in with another extension at the base, and that the call was being monitored. The conversation on the phone made a slight change in Barney's attitude. From his discussion with the officer, Barney learned of other reports, some similar to his, so that he no longer felt as self-conscious about the possibility of being considered irrational in reporting something that he couldn't explain. Both refrained, however, from telling about the shiny spots on the car. Barney's main concern was not to appear foolish. On the next day, some of his concern in this respect was reduced when the Peace Air Force Base called back for further information. It was Major Paul W. Henderson of the 100th Bomb Wing at the Peace Base who called and told the Hills he had stayed up all night working on the report and wanted a few more details. His official report to the Air Force unit at Wright-Patterson Field, Ohio, concludes, "The reliability of the observer cannot be judged, and while his apparent honesty and seriousness appears to be valid, it cannot be judged at this time." Struggling to find some correlation between fantasy and fact, Barney suggested to Betty that they each draw a sketch of their impressions of the object. Betty agreed. Sitting in separate rooms, they roughed out two sketches, which, when compared, were remarkably similar. Even though Barney's lengthy conversation with the Air Force Major reinforced his confidence in his own sighting, he still wasn't a full believer in unidentified flying objects. Later, this dichotomy was to bother him, to reflect itself in the worsening of his ulcer condition that up to this point had been improving considerably. Where Barney recoiled from the situation, Betty's curiosity was ignited. 2 days later, she went to the library to find any possible information on unidentified flying objects. A book by Major Donald Kehoe, The Flying Saucer Conspiracy, commanded her attention. Major Kehoe's thesis in the book indicated that the Air Force was making a serious effort to discredit all UFO sightings at the expense of open scientific inquiry. A former Annapolis graduate and Marine Corps major, Kehoe was instrumental in establishing an organization known as the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena in Washington to correlate and analyze every available UFO sighting in an attempt to find a solution to the mystery and to prepare the public, if necessary, for the possibility that the objects may be extraterrestrial spacecraft of unknown origin. NICAP, as Major Kehoe's organization has come to be known, arrived at the conclusion that there are basically only two explanations for the consistent, worldwide reporting of UFOs every year. One, widespread and presently unaccountable delusion on a scale so vast that it should be in itself a matter of urgent scientific study. Two, people are seeing maneuvering, apparently controlled objects in the atmosphere. Members of NICAP, many of whom are reputable scientists, professors, technicians, pilots, and former high-ranking military officers, argue that the second hypothesis is the more reasonable, and that it is grounded on empirical observations. In its carefully documented study, the UFO Evidence, the organization analyzes 575 technical and other reliable reports from 46 states, Puerto Rico, Mexico, Canada, and other countries throughout the world. NICAP investigators, serving on a voluntary basis, are instructed to document each case in painstaking detail and to contest wherever possible any wild and irresponsible reports of sightings from the lunatic fringe that has so frequently seized on the subject for either self-aggrandizement or profit. On reading Major Kehoe's book, Betty gained more confidence. She lost little time in sitting down to write him a letter about her own experience. For the first time in this letter, she was willing to talk about Barney's description of the figures within the craft, although she did so with Barney's extremely reluctant approval. Some 10 days after the sightings, Betty began having a series of vivid dreams. They continued for 5 successive nights. Never in her memory had she recalled dreams of such detail and intensity. A few weeks later, a puzzling incident occurred that neither Barney nor Betty could explain. They were driving in the car through the countryside near Portsmouth on a road in a sparsely populated area. Up ahead of them, a parked car was partially blocking the road. A group of people were standing outside the car, and Barney began to slow down gradually to avoid an accident. Suddenly, Betty was overcome by fear. She could not explain it even to herself. "Barney," she said, "Barney, keep going. Please don't slow down. Keep going. Keep going." And she found herself starting to open the car door on the passenger side with an almost uncontrollable impulse to jump out of the car and run. Barney was startled and tried to find out what was wrong. Betty was nearing a state of panic. Without asking any more questions, Barney speeded up as fast as possible with people partially blocking the road, and Betty recovered her equilibrium. What disturbed her most was that she was not at all inclined to be this emotional. The impact of the inexplainable incident stayed with them for many days afterward, as well as the effect of the nightmares on Betty that still persisted. Realizing that Barney was attempting to put the UFO event out of his mind, Betty refrained from discussing the nightmares with him. But she began telling a few close friends, one of whom was a fellow social worker, who urged her to write down her dreams. Feeling that this might relieve her conscious preoccupation with them, she sat down at her typewriter and wrote. Her dreams were unusual in subject matter and detail. They revealed that she encountered a strange roadblock on a lonely New Hampshire road as a group of men approached the car. The men were dressed alike. As soon as they reached the car, she slipped into unconsciousness. She awoke to find herself and Barney being taken aboard a wholly strange craft, where she was given a complete physical examination by intelligent humanoid beings. Barney was taken off down a corridor, curving to the contour of the ship for apparently the same reason. They were assured in the dream that no harm would come to them, and that they would be released without any conscious memory of the strange happening. On October the 19th, 1961, Walter Webb, lecturer on the staff of the Hayden Planetarium in Boston, opened his mail to read a letter from Richard Hall, then secretary to NICAP. Webb occasionally investigated the more serious and puzzling UFO reports in the New England area, drafting a detailed document for Washington when the merits of the case warranted it. Hall's letter included a copy of the letter Betty Hill had written to Major Kehoe and suggested to Webb that it might be worthwhile to drive the 80 miles north of Boston to Portsmouth to investigate the case. Webb, who had joined the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge shortly after his graduation from college in 1956, had been interested in unidentified flying objects since 1951 when, as a counselor at a boys' camp in Michigan, he had made a sighting while training campers in the use of a telescope. His own sighting was totally convincing to him, but his intense interest in the subject did not bloom fully until the summer of 1952, when a now-famous group of sightings was made over Washington, recorded on several radar screens and confirmed by competent visual observers both in the air and on the ground. Many details on this event were quickly hushed by the Air Force, and further intelligent study of the phenomenon was rendered impossible. Webb's first reaction to Richard Hall's letter was reluctance. It was plain that this case involved a report of the movement of beings on the craft, and Webb was skeptical of this type of sighting. He drove up to Portsmouth on October the 21st, 1961. In his mind were thoughts of the sensational nature of the claim, the possibility that the Hills might be seeking publicity, perpetrating a hoax, or suffering from a mental aberration. On the other hand, he felt that Betty Hill's letter was extremely literate, an honest and straightforward account of a frightening experience which had happened to two people. As an interviewer with a scientific background, he was certain he could create a slip-up somewhere if the Hills' story was spurious. He arrived at the Hills' house at about noon and began the interview, which continued until 8 that evening. "I was so impressed by both the Hills and their account," Walter Webb later said, that we skipped lunch and went right through the afternoon and early evening. During that time, I cross-examined them together, separately, together, re-questioned them again and again. I tried to make them slip up somewhere, and I couldn't. I simply couldn't. Theirs was an ironclad story. They seemed to me to be a sincere, honest couple, driving home from vacation late at night on a lonely road, when suddenly something completely unknown and unidentifiable descended on them. Something entirely foreign or alien to their existence. During the interview, the Hills gave Webb their sketches, drawn independently, yet comparing so identically. Walter Webb had a map with him, and he carefully used it to fill in a complete timetable of the Hills' journey. For some reason, although the Hills explained in detail about the shiny spots on the car, they forgot to show them to him, and Webb forgot to ask to examine them. None of the three can explain this oversight. At the close of the session, Webb suggested to the Hills that they drive back over the trip, trying to pin down the exact spots where varied events happened. Driving back to Boston, Webb mentally reviewed the case. His doubts about a hoax were dispelled. "I had read of such cases before," Webb said later, "but this is the first time I had come in contact with apparently reliable witnesses who claimed to have seen UFO occupants. I was impressed that the Hills underplayed the dramatic aspects of the case. They were not trying to sensationalize. They wanted me to keep this just to myself, confidential with NICAP. Barney's complete resistance to the idea of UFOs was most convincing. There were two different personalities here, in a way. Barney, the more careful, scientific, accurate person, and Betty, the talker. But at the same time, she didn't overdo it either." 5 days later, Webb prepared his report for NICAP in Washington, reviewing the incident in the minutest detail, including compass directions, position of the moon and planets, weather, and detailed descriptions of the object, including the sketches the Hills had given him. He concluded his lengthy report, "It is the opinion of this investigator, after questioning these people for over 6 hours and studying their reactions and personalities during that time, that they were telling the truth, and the incident occurred exactly as reported, except for some minor uncertainties and technicalities that must be tolerated in any such observation where human judgment is involved." On November 2, 1961, Webb wrote the Hills to thank them for their cooperation, indicating that he had submitted his extensive report to NICAP. About a month before Webb filed his NICAP report, Robert Homan, a scientific writer for one of the world's most notable corporations in the electronic industry, and C.D. Jackson, a senior engineer for the same company, went to Washington to attend the 12th International Astronautical Congress. As technicians working in advanced fields of science, both men were interested in the data being accumulated on the UFO subject by NICAP and arranged to have lunch with Major Kehoe. Kehoe brought up the letter NICAP had just received from the Hills, one of the organization's most interesting cases in many months. Homan and Jackson were at once interested, but the story seemed so incredible that they were cautious in accepting it. They finally got in touch with Walter Webb, who had just completed his report. He sent them a copy, and they studied it carefully. Knowing of Webb's reputation for accuracy, they were considerably impressed. His appraisal of the character and competence of the Hills led them to take immediate action. On November 3, 1961, they wrote the Hills and asked for a meeting. On November 25, they arrived in Portsmouth to review the story of the strange experience. Visiting the Hills at the time was Major James McDonald, an Air Force intelligence officer who had just recently retired from active duty and a friend of the Hills. The group, Betty and Barney Hill, Robert Homan, C.D. Jackson, and Major McDonald, conferred for another long session beginning at noon and running almost until midnight. The Hills were impressed by the businesslike and professional attitude of Homan and Jackson, with Barney again reflecting surprise that so much attention was being directed toward a subject he still had lingering doubts about in spite of his own traumatic experience. Homan and Jackson inquired about many facets in the case that puzzled Barney, particularly an inquiry as to whether there were any nitrates or nitrate derivatives in the Hills' car. "The only thing I could think of that possibly had some connection with nitrates," Barney later said, "was gunpowder. I did have about a dozen shotgun shells in the car left over from a trip to the South when I had practiced shooting at tin cans on my uncle's farm. But aside from that, I couldn't think of anything." The reason that they were asking, they said, was that in several close UFO encounters, the people had been in rural areas where they were exposed to nitrates or nitrate fertilizer. "Then it hit us. Betty had left the bone meal fertilizer in the trunk of the car before the trip, and I hadn't bothered to take it out. Betty Hill recalled, "While they were here, they were mentally reconstructing the whole trip. One of them said, 'What took you so long to get home?' They said, 'Look, you went this distance and you took these hours. Where were you?' Well, when they said this, I thought I was really going to crack up. I got terrified, and I even put my head on the table. I became suddenly flabbergasted," Barney added in his words, "to think that I realized for the first time, at the rate of speed I always travel, we should have arrived home at least 2 hours earlier than we did." To the entire group in the Hill living room that afternoon, the missing time period became a major mystery. The Hills tried, but simply could not account for it. Nor could they account for the 35 miles between Indian Head and Ashland, during which their recollection amounted to almost nothing. For the first time, it fully dawned on them that they were facing a period of simultaneous amnesia, experienced by each of them at the same time, falling roughly between the first series of beeps that emanated from the back of their car and the second series of beeps they encountered somewhere near Ashland, 35 miles to the south. The thought that plagued everyone at the meeting was that while it was unusual enough for one person to be struck suddenly with a temporary period of amnesia, it was very strange for two intelligent people to experience it together under such fantastic conditions. As a hard-headed former intelligence officer in the Air Force, Major James McDonald groped for some kind of answer to the puzzle. He was fascinated by the probe that Homan and Jackson were conducting, impressed by their attention to detail and their posing of interesting and imponderable questions. But most critical of all, what happened in the 2 hours when the Hills suffered double amnesia? What could have happened? What did happen? It was at this point in the informal gathering that Major McDonald suggested the possibility of medical hypnosis. It was agreed that the idea of medical hypnosis was a good one, but the problem became one of finding the proper medical man to take the case. No one immediately came to mind. Homan, Jackson, and Major McDonald agreed to make further inquiries, and the Hills both felt the idea had merit. "I agree with the idea wholeheartedly," Betty later said, "because the moment they suggested hypnosis, I thought of my dreams, and this was the first time I began to wonder if they were more than just dreams." "My reaction to the hypnosis idea," Barney added, "was first, what are the effects of hypnosis? What is it about?" It was to be some time before the Hills were able to follow up the suggestion. In the meantime, the compulsion grew in both of them that they must return to the scene of the incident, as Walter Webb had suggested. Finally, in February of 1962, a series of pilgrimages began that were to continue for many months in all seasons. At first, they would go two or three times a month. Later, they were to skip many weeks at a time, but always with the same questions to answer. What happened during the inexplicable blackout? The idea of hypnosis was temporarily tabled. Neither Homan, Jackson, nor Major McDonald could suggest a psychiatrist, and Betty especially hoped that the return trips to the area might spark a chain of memory that would suddenly bring back their recall. At Cannon Mountain, Indian Head, and Lancaster, they would reenact their frequent stops, in the hopes that the repetition of the process might stimulate their memories. Yet the return trips were fruitless. Always the same curtain of darkness for Barney after the critical moment at Indian Head. Always the blind veil for Betty after the strange series of beeps as they drove frantically away from Indian Head, with Barney, apparently in great emotional distress, at the wheel. The long commuting drive from Portsmouth to Boston, the night work schedule, the separation from his sons who were living in Philadelphia with his former wife, the doubts about the Indian Head experience, and the problem with his ulcers all began to take their toll on Barney. His condition was further complicated by the recurrence of elevated blood pressure, creating a vicious circle whereby he could not successfully remedy the last condition without the removal of the other problems, and vice versa. Another disturbing symptom began at this time, more of an annoyance than anything else, but contributing to his general problem. A series of warts began to develop in an almost geometrically perfect circular ring in the area of his groin. While they were a minor problem, they added to his concern. By the summer of 1962, Barney's exhaustion and general malaise prompted him to seek out a psychiatrist, Dr. Duncan Stevens, for his overall condition, entirely aside from the traumatic experience he and Betty had had in the White Mountains. For a full year, from the summer of 1962 through the following summer of 1963, Barney continued working through his problems with Dr. Stevens, but never emphasizing and only briefly considering the UFO incident. One evening in September of 1963, the Hills were invited by their church discussion group to relate, for the first time at any kind of gathering, their experience with the UFO in the White Mountains. At the discussion group meeting was another invited speaker, Captain Ben Sweat, from the nearby Peace Air Force Base, who was well known in that area for a study of hypnosis, a subject which, together with the story the Hills would tell, might make up an interesting evening. After the captain listened to our story, as much as we could tell with the blanking out of memory that took place at the moment in Indian Head, he was interested that the account was cut off as if by a cleaver at that point, Barney recalls. We mentioned the fact that Holman Jackson and Major McDonald had recommended hypnosis, and as a man well acquainted with it himself, the captain suggested this might be a good idea, especially if it were conducted by a psychiatrist. At his next session with Dr. Stevens, Barney brought up the subject. The doctor told him that even though the UFO incident might be a sidelight, they should leave no stone unturned in examining Barney's anxieties. Dr. Stevens also indicated to Barney that simultaneous hallucination, to say nothing of simultaneous amnesia, was highly unlikely, although there is a rare psychological phenomenon known as a folie à deux, in which two people develop a psychotic condition in which their beliefs and delusions are similar. This also seemed unlikely, since most of the conditions for this phenomenon did not seem to be present. Except for the possibility of this one traumatic experience, there were no particular symptoms mutually reflected in their constant day-to-day relationships as husband and wife over the entire period that they had been married. Dr. Stevens found it advisable at this point to have the opinion of Dr. Benjamin Simon, a well-known Boston psychiatrist and urologist. Dr. Simon was a graduate of Stanford University and received his M.D. from Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. While an undergraduate at Johns Hopkins University, he became interested in hypnosis when he served as a subject in some experiments conducted by the psychology department there. During his psychiatric and neurological training, he developed proficiency in techniques and procedures. While on a Rockefeller Foundation fellowship in Europe in 1937 and 38, he further extended the knowledge which was to prove so useful a few years later. In World War II, he founded a very useful adjunct in the treatment of military psychiatric disorders, first as consultant psychiatrist to the General Dispensary in New York, and later on a very extensive scale as chief of neuropsychiatry and executive officer at Mason General Hospital, the Army's chief psychiatric center in World War II. When John Huston produced his documentary on psychiatric treatment, Let There Be Light, at the Mason General Hospital, Colonel Simon served as advisor and personally did the scenes involving hypnosis and narcosynthesis. For his work as Chief of Neuropsychiatry and Executive Officer, he was awarded the Legion of Merit and the Army Commendation Medal. In his office on Bay State Road in Boston, Dr. Simon received a call from Barney Hill early in December of 1963. Since the referral was made by Dr. Stevens, Dr. Simon set up an appointment for a consultation on December the 14th. Barney and Betty Hill left Portsmouth well before 7 o'clock on the morning of December the 14th, driving in and parking their car near Dr. Simon's offices with a comfortable margin of time before their appointment at 8. They approached the consultation with mingled feelings of curiosity, nervousness, and some apprehension, although these feelings were tempered with the relief that comes from taking a decisive step in action in the direction they thought would help. Betty, who had never been in therapy, was faintly amused at the fact that she had often escorted some of her welfare cases into psychiatric clinics, and now the tables were about to be turned. Barney, whose therapy had been continuing for many months, was curious about the possibility that they might be going to undergo hypnosis. He was anxious to see if indeed he could be hypnotized and what sort of method would be used to accomplish this. Dr. Simon, somewhat surprised to note the interracial marriage of his patients, began with a general history of their problems, highlighted, of course, by the incident at Indian Head 2 years before. Dr. Simon was aware that Barney had been undergoing therapy for his anxiety state, and that it was increasingly apparent that the experience with the unidentified flying object was an important facet in his failure to respond adequately to his treatment. He was similarly aware of the nightmares leading to Betty's anxiety. It became quickly apparent that both Barney and Betty needed treatment. Treatment would be centered on their anxiety reaction with the apparent amnesia for part of the experiences in the White Mountains as the point of departure. There were practical questions, too, for both of them. The matter of cost was something they could not ignore. Their combined income was reasonably comfortable, but with two of them in therapy, they realized, there would be a severe strain on the budget, and the job of psychiatric treatment could not be accomplished over a short period of time. In addition to the fees that a competent psychiatrist would set, There was the not inconsiderable cost of driving to Boston each week for a double session. This was a serious business to them, not a whim or fancy, and they accepted it as such. The unidentified flying object aspect was a secondary matter to Dr. Simon, because his first and major job was to determine the treatment and aid the patients in overcoming their psychiatric problems. The general attitude of Dr. Simon to UFOs was neutral, tempered by a hard-headed realism that such objects could exist, as experimental aircraft or foreign reconnaissance craft not yet announced to the layman, or simply mistaken aircraft or stars. He had no personal interest in the subject and was willing to accept whatever authoritative sources said about it. At the consultation that morning, Dr. Simon evaluated their cases and gave an outline of his treatment plan. Because the purported amnesia was a central factor in their distress, he planned to begin by using hypnosis to penetrate the amnesia, if this was what the condition turned out to be, and to proceed according to the developments. Dr. Simon also decided to record the therapeutic sessions on tape, both for an accurate record and for probable use to bring the material into consciousness under controlled conditions. During hypnosis, the incidents described in the trance can be wiped from conscious memory. Conversely, on instructions from the doctor, they can be recalled. For the most real reproduction of the trance experience, the patient can listen to his own voice on tape and analyze it with the doctor step by step. Barney and Betty Hill, like most laymen, had only a smattering of knowledge about hypnosis. Dr. Simon explained to them that the process was a close relationship between the doctor and the patient, in which the Hills would be brought into a condition like sleep. There would be no danger of harm to them. They should have nothing to fear. At 8 in the morning on Saturday, January the 4th, 1964, the Hills arrived at the doctor's office on Bay State Road for their first regular visit after the initial consultation. It was to be the first of three sessions in which the doctor would repeatedly induce hypnosis as a conditioning process. During these sessions, both of the Hills responded well, and the doctor was satisfied that they would be good subjects able to attain the depth of trance desired. The repetition of the process over the three-week period would serve to reinforce the induction and to establish specific post-hypnotic cue words to replace future induction procedures. In this way, the subsequent inductions would be quick and sure. With both subjects clearly responding to the induction, the doctor could now continue with future sessions simply by stating the established cue words that would produce the trance. He would, however, play safe by repeated deep trance inductions. With the tests and induction period over after the third session, the Hills looked forward to the start of the therapeutic sessions with the hope that once and for all the mystery at Indian Head would be cleared up. The Hills arrived at the usual early morning hour at Dr. Simon's office on February the 22nd, 1964, Betty realizing that she would merely be going to have her induction reinforced, and Barney ready to make his excursion into the unknown. The doctor's procedure was clear for this session. After he reinforced Betty, the simple process of rehypnotizing her so that she would maintain her capacity for the deep trance state when the time for her sessions came later, he would have Barney go back to the night of the journey and retrace it in detail. A psychologically determined amnesia is commonly the loss of memory for painful ideas or experiences that serves to keep them out of consciousness. Through the concentration of attention brought on by hypnosis, the opposite of amnesia is often created, hypermnesia or superlative memory. In this session, it was hoped that not only would the forgotten material be recalled, but that the accompanying emotions would be re-experienced. For the tape recording of the session, Dr. Simon used a Revere M2 automatic cartridge loading recorder at 1 7/8 IPS. The cartridges were not only long playing, but they could be stacked ahead of time so that there would be a minimum of interruption during the sessions. Where an interruption was necessary, the procedure was simple. The doctor would simply tap Barney on the head, tell him that he would hear no sound whatsoever during the intermission period, and then tap him on the head again to continue. A subject under hypnosis has such accuracy of recall and retention that he will continue at the exact point left off, even if he is in the middle of a sentence. Barney took his seat in front of the doctor's desk. He started to reach for a cigarette, but on the cue words from Dr. Simon, his eyes closed and his head nodded. His hands were folded across his lap. He looked like anyone who had dozed over his morning paper while he sat in an easy chair. The deep trance was induced. And satisfying himself that Barney was fully in the trance state, the doctor began the session.
Good also deeper and deeper, deeper asleep, far asleep. Deeper and deeper. Fully relaxed, all muscles are relaxed, you're comfortable, relaxed. You will not be anxious or distressed, but you will remember everything and you will tell me everything.
Yes. I think I will stop. I will stop. And I have not stopped. And Betty said, look, there's a star moving. And I look and I see a star. It's funny. But I said, Betty, that's a satellite. We are seeing a satellite. And then I pulled over to the side of the road. And Betty jumped out her side, on her side, with the binoculars. And I got the chain. And I hook it to the dog on her collar. And I say, come on, Dulcie, let's get out. She jumps out. And I look toward the sky, and I look back to Dulcie and walk her around the trunk of the car. And I'm saying, hurry up, Betty, so I can get a look. And Betty passes the binoculars to me. And I see that this is not a satellite. It is an airplane. It is an airplane. You can see, I think, you can see the rows of windows, and it is an airplane. And I tell Betty this and give the binoculars back to her. And I am satisfied. And I drive, and Betty is still looking, and she says, Barney, that is not a plane. It is still following us. And I stop, and I look, and I see it is still out there, off in the distance. So I search for a place to pull off the road. And I see a dirt road to the right of the main highway. And I think this is a good place I can pull off. And if any car comes, it won't strike me. And I am thinking, this is strange, because it is still there. And Betty said, I think she said, I am mad with her, I said. I believe Betty is trying to make me think this is a flying saucer.
Was it light enough to see?
It was just a light moving through the sky. And I heard no noise. And I think, this is ridiculous. And Betty, it is not a flying saucer. What are you doing that for? You want to believe in this thing. And I don't. And I can't hear any sound.
No sound, whatever.
I want to hear a jet. Oh, I want to hear a jet so badly.
Why
I want to hear it.
Why do you want to hear a jet?
because Betty is making me mad. She is making me angry because she is saying, look at that. It's strange. It's not a plane. Look at it. And I keep thinking it's got to be. And I want to hear a hum. I want to hear a motor.
How far away was it?
It was, it wasn't far. It was about 1,000 feet, I guess.
1,000 feet?
1,000 feet.
Did it go back and forth, or did it go in circles like a plane does?
It would go toward the west, and without looking as if it turned, it would come straight back. It would go like I think of a paddle and a ball with a rubber. And you hit the ball, and the ball goes straight out and comes straight back without a circle. And I think only a jet could fly that fast. And I am hoping I can find a good place where I can stop and really see this thing, whatever it is. And I see a wigwam, and I recognize this place, and I feel safe. I feel less in the barren hostility.
What is this place?
Wooded area.
What is this place?
It is Indian Head. I had been there before, and I feel comforted that I see a familiar place. And I think I will get a good look at this, because Betty was very annoying. She was annoying by telling me, look, and I can't look. I have to drive the car. I want to wake up.
You're not going to wake up. You're in deep sleep. You're comfortable. Relax. This is not going to trouble you. Go on. You can remember everything now.
It's right over my right. God. What is it? And I try to maintain control so Betty cannot tell I am scared. God, I'm scared.
It's all right. You could go right on and experience it. It will not hurt you now.
I got to get my gun. I got to get my gun!
All right. All right, that's all. Go to sleep, Steve. You forget now. You're forgotten. Calm now. Relaxed. Deeply relaxed. You will not have to make any outcry. But you can remember it now. Keep remembering. You feel you have to get your gun. This is going to harm you, you felt.
I open the trunk of my car, and I get it, and I get back in the car.
All right, just keep reasonably calm.
And I put it in my coat, and then I get out with the binoculars, and it is there, and I look, and I look. And it shifts over, and I think, I'm not afraid. whole unit down. I'm not afraid. And I walk out, and I walk across the road. And there it is, up there. Oh, God, there it is.
Calm down. Calm down, it's there, but you can see it, but it's not going to hurt you. Go on.
Why doesn't it go away? Look at it. It's better.
Calm. It's not going to hurt you.
There's a man. Is he a captain? What is he? It's gonna look at me.
Just a minute. Let's go back a little bit now. You say it's there. Did you say it was 1,000 feet away?
Oh, no.
1,000 yards?
It doesn't look that far. It's very big. And it's not that far. And I can see it tilted toward me.
Tilted? And what does it look like now when you say tilted? Did you see
it
wings?
Looks like a big, big pancake with windows and rows of windows and lights of not light, just one huge light.
And rows of windows like a commercial plane?
Rows of windows. They're not like a commercial plane because they curve around to the size of this pancake. And I say, my God, no. I have to shake my head. I got to. It can't be true. This isn't there. It's still there. And I look up and down the road. Can't somebody come and tell me this is not there? It can't be. And oh.
You're still asleep, but you can see it all clearly.
It's there.
You sure it's there?
Yeah.
You weren't having a dream?
It's there.
You'd had no sleep that evening?
I touch my right arm. It's not my right, it's my left arm. And then I touch my right arm. And it is my left arm. I'm confused.
You're clear now. You're relaxed.
It's still there. If I let my binoculars fall and dangle from my neck and then start over again, maybe it won't be there. But it is. Why? What do they want? What do they want? One person looks friendly. He's friendly looking. And he's looking at me over his right shoulder. And he's smiling.
Could you see him clearly?
Yes, I thought.
What's his face like? What does it make you think of?
It's round. I think of a red-haired Irishman. I don't know why. But I think I know why. because Irish are usually hostile to Negroes. And when I see a friendly Irish person, I react to it by thinking I will be friendly. And I think this one that is looking over his shoulder is friendly.
You say looking over his shoulder, was he facing away from you?
Yes, he was facing a wall.
You saw him through this window, or you said there was a row of windows?
It was a row of windows. Just a huge row of windows, only divided by struts or structures that prevented it from being one solid window. Or then it would have been one solid window. And the evil face on the, he looked like a German Nazi.
He is not. Did he have on a uniform?
Yes.
What kind of uniform?
It was black. He had a black scarf around his neck, dangling over his left shoulder.
You pointed it out as if it were on you.
I never noticed that before.
He had a black scarf on his neck. How could you see these figures so clearly at that distance?
I was looking at them with binoculars.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Did they have faces like other people? You say one reminded you of a red-headed Irishman.
His eyes were slanted. I see it so. His eyes were slanted. But not like a Chinese.
What was Betty doing all this time?
I'm not close to her. I don't know.
You're out there by yourself,
huh? Yes.
Don't think of her. Is she saying anything?
I can't hear her.
Did you make any outcry to her the way you did to me?
I can't remember. I don't know. I did not.
You would remember it if you did.
I did not. But I know this creature, this leader, is telling me something.
He's telling you something. How? How's he getting it to you?
I can see it in his face.
Do you see his lips move? Yes.
No, his lips aren't moving.
Yes, go on. He's telling you.
And he's looking at me.
What did he tell you?
Stay there and keep looking. Just keep looking and stay there. And just keep looking. Just keep looking.
Could you hear him tell you?
Oh, I gotta pull these binoculars away from my eyes. Because if I don't, I'll just keep staying there.
Could you hear him tell you this?
Oh, no. He didn't say it.
You felt he said it.
I know.
You know he said it.
Just stay there, yeah. Just stay there, he's saying to me.
All right.
It's bouncing in my head. Just pull the binoculars away. God, give me strength.
All right.
Pull him down. Run. Pull his binoculars down and run. God. If there's a God, give me strength. I gotta get away. Oh. Oh.
All right.
You gotta get away,
Betty. All right. Calm down.
I'm driving.
Calm down.
You gotta get away.
How could you be sure he was telling you this? Calm down. You're still asleep.
Oh.
How could you be sure he was telling you this?
His eyes. I've never seen his eyes before.
But you said they were friendly. You said they were friendly.
Oh, no. Not the leaders. I said only the one looking over his shoulder.
Oh, I see. The leader
was friendly.
How did you know the other one was the leader?
Because everybody moved. Everyone was standing there looking at me. But everybody moved to these levers or in the back, or they went to this big board. They looked like it looked like a board. And only this one with the black shiny jacket and the scarf stayed at the window. I'm driving.
You going back into the car now?
Yes.
You took down your binoculars, did you?
I got them down.
Yes. And you got into the car. Did you speak to Betty?
Getting a hold of myself. I'm saying a hold to myself. Don't panic. Remember, you got a great fortitude. You can drive the car. And I told Betty to look out. The object was still around us. I could feel it around us. I saw it when we passed by the object. When I got into the car, it had swung around so that it was out there. I knew it was out there. Well, it's out there. But I don't know where.
Speak a little louder.
I know Route 3. Oh, those eyes. They're there in my brain. Oh, please. Can I wake up?
Stay asleep a little longer.
Oh.
We'll get through this now, all right. We'll get through it all right. All of your feelings, tell me. But it won't upset you so much.
There. Isn't that funny? Out of the woods.
Yes.
That crazy dog. She stays in the car all the time. Isn't that funny? She stays in the car.
She doesn't bark, do anything?
No, she just stays there.
What about Betty?
I don't know.
Isn't she saying anything?
I don't understand. Are we being robbed? I don't know.
What makes you think you're being robbed?
I know it's in my mind and I don't want to say it.
Well, you can say it to me. You can say it now.
They're men. All with black jackets. And I don't have any money. I don't have anything. I No. Oh. Oh. The eyes are there. Always the eyes are there. And they're telling me. I don't have to be afraid. Is there an accident on the road? What's the red? The bright red.
Bright red?
Yeah.
What is that?
Orange and red.
Where is that?
Right down the road.
Down the road.
I don't have to be afraid. But they won't talk to me.
Who won't talk to you?
The men.
In the vehicle?
No, they're standing in the road.
And where are you? You're in the car?
No. I'm just suspended. I'm just floating about. Oh, how funny. Float about. What's floating? Nothing. I want to get back to the car, but I'm just floating.
You really floating about, or is that the way you feel?
That's the way I feel.
You're still outside of the car?
No.
You're in the car.
I'm not in the car. I'm not near the car. I'm not in the woods. I'm not on the road.
Well, where are these men?
I don't know.
On the road.
I don't know. I'm just floating about. Oh, geez. That's the funniest thing, Betty. Funniest thing. I never believed in flying saucers, but I don't know. Mighty mysterious. Yeah. I guess I won't say anything to anybody about this. It's too ridiculous, isn't it? Oh, yeah, it's really funny. Wonder where they came from. Oh, geez, I wish I had gone with them.
You wish you had gone with them?
Yes. Oh, what a experience to go to some distant planet. Maybe this will prove the existence of God. Isn't that funny? You look for the existence of God in other planets. Were you scared? I wasn't. No, I wasn't afraid. I wasn't anything anyway. It was very ridiculous just you and I talking about it. Well, we're getting into Portsmouth a little later than I expected.
All right, we'll stop there. You'll be calm and relaxed. You will forget everything that we have had this period together until I ask you to recall it again. You'll forget everything we have had, Nung, until I ask you to recall it again. You may wake now.
Wow. 10 minutes after 8. Didn't you bring me in here 10 minutes after 8?
Yes.
What was it, 10? Where was I?
Been right here. Me?
What am I cigarette? Was I about to reach for a cigarette?
Look that way. Go ahead and have one.
I thought I was coming in here and you asked me to take this seat, this chair. And then I was going to reach for a cigarette. But I never reached for it.
So how do you feel?
I feel fine.
Good. You know what happened here?
I know you put me into a trance. I know the purpose of it, but I don't know.
That's all right. We'll continue this next week, a week from today.
The first probe into the unknown had been made, but the amnesiac veil had scarcely been pierced. What was to follow, none of the three knew, and at this point, only the doctor was aware of what had been uncovered. Barney had no true recall about what had happened in the session, except for some vague and fleeting impressions. It did not seem to him that he had been under hypnosis for more than a few minutes. On February the 29th, 1964, the Hills arrived punctually for their appointment, Betty being reinforced again, and Barney remaining in the office for a second therapeutic session. Before putting him in the customary trance, Dr. Simon asked him a few questions in review.
What was it you saw down the highway?
I saw a group of men, and they were standing in the highway, and they came, and they assisted me.
Okay, who assisted you?
These men.
They assisted you out of the car?
Yes.
That's what you said?
Mm-hmm. I am only thinking of mental pictures because my eyes are closed and I think I am going up a slight incline and my feet are not bumping on the rocks. That's funny. I thought of my feet bumping on the rocks. And they are going up smoothly. But I'm afraid to open my eyes because I am being told strongly by myself to keep my eyes closed and don't open them. And I don't want to be operated on.
You don't want to be operated on? What makes you think of an operation?
I don't know.
You were thinking about this when you were there on the road?
I was thinking about this when I was lying on my stomach.
Where were you lying on your stomach?
I thought I was inside something, but I did not dare open my eyes. I had been told to keep my eyes closed.
Who told you that?
The man.
What man?
That I saw through the binoculars.
Was this one of the men in the road?
No.
Well, who were these men in the road? Or what part did they play in this?
They took me and carried me up this ramp.
Did you feel you were going to be operated on?
No.
Did you feel you were going to be attacked in any way?
No. I was laying on the table, and my fly was open, and I thought, are they putting a cup around my private parts? And then it stopped. And I thought, how funny.
Speak a little louder, if you please.
I thought, how funny if I keep real quiet and real still, I won't be harmed, and it will be over, and am walking, and I am walking, and am being guided, and my eyes are closed, and I open my eyes, and there is the car, and the lights are off, and it is not running, and Dulcie is under the seat, and I reached under and touched her, and she is in a tight ball under the seat, and I sit back, and I see Betty is coming down the road, and she gets into the car, and I am grinning at her, and she is grinning back at me, and we both seem so elated, and we are really happy, and I'm thinking, it isn't too bad. How funny. I have no reason to fear. And we look, and I see a bright moon. And I laugh and say, well, there it goes. And I'm happy.
Barney woke, feeling calm and refreshed. He had no memory whatever of what had gone on during the session. With the second session over, Dr. Simon reviewed the case in the first real light that had been thrown on the amnesiac period. The case was breaking down into two separate phases. The first encounter, which was described as happening at Indian Head, and the second encounter, which apparently took place in a wooded section of a road off Route 3, involving a roadblock and the bizarre description of an abduction aboard a spaceship. The evidence revealed in the two sessions with Barney seemed to indicate that he had undergone a severe emotional upheaval with an experience with an unidentified object, either real or interpreted to be real. The second experience, the abduction, had much less support from established reports of the UFO phenomenon and had to be considered as far less probable or unreal. Much more data would have to be available to weigh the scales convincingly as far as this was concerned. At this stage of the treatment, it appeared that part or all of the first encounter could be real. The second encounter had no valid precedent and appeared to be unreal, consequently reflecting back on the first experience. At Dr. Simon's office on March the 7th, 1964, the procedure was reversed. Barney was reinforced and Betty remained in the office for the session to begin. She distinctly remembered hearing the cue words as they were spoken by the doctor at her first long session. But almost immediately, she thought, she heard the words from the doctor, "You may wake up, Betty." In between the phrases, for over an hour, Betty re-experienced in full, detail the incident at Cannon Mountain. What she revealed would not be known to her for weeks later.
We're driving along. I don't know where we are. I don't even know how we got here. So Patty and I, we've been driving, and I don't know how long, and we haven't even been talking. I've just been sitting here feeling that something's going to happen. And I'm not really too afraid. Except right now I am. And that time I didn't feel afraid.
Why are you crying if you're not afraid?
I'm afraid now, but I wasn't. I wasn't afraid. I was afraid when I saw the men in the road.
Men in the road?
I've never been so afraid in my life.
Tell me about the men in the road. It's all right now. You're safe here. Tell me about the men in the road.
We're driving along. We're on a tad road. And all of a sudden, without any warning or any reason or rhyme or anything, Fanny made a... He almost... The brakes, I think, even squealed. He stopped so suddenly and made this sharp left-hand turn to the highway, and we went onto this narrow road. I was wondering what he was doing down here, but he wasn't saying anything, and I wasn't. I figured, well, maybe we're lost, but so what? We'll come out somewhere. And we're going along, and there was a sharp curve in the road. And as we went around the curve, there were trees. There were a lot of tall trees on my side. I don't know about Bonnie's side of the road, but there was these men standing in the highway. And I wasn't too afraid when I saw them. They were standing there. And I thought, well, you know, there was several. There was, oh, I don't know. And they were just, you couldn't get a good look at them. But then I thought, well, you know, are they in a car and the car broken down, or what are they doing there? And Bonnie, of course, had to stop. And then he stopped the car, and these men started to come up to the car. They separated. They came up in two groups. And when they started to do that, I got real scared. And the car motor died. The car stalled. And when they started coming up, Bonnie tried to start the car. He tried to start it, and you know how a motor of a car would just turn over, it won't fire. And he tried to start the car.
You did what?
He tried to start the car,
yes.
And it won't start. And the men are coming towards us. And I think, well, I can't get away from this. If I get the car door open, I can run in the woods and hide. And I'm thinking, and I just put my hand on the car door to open it. And the men come up, and they open it for me. And they open the car door. And there's not very big men. And there's 1, 2, 3 next to me. And then there's 2 men behind.
I didn't hear that.
2 men. There's a car door. And there's 1, 2, 3 men.
Yes.
And then there's 1, 2 more behind them.
Yes.
And one man puts his hand out. I don't know what happened.
You can remember everything now. What do these men look like? Could you see their faces?
No.
How were they dressed?
Alike, somehow or other.
But they haven't worn any uniform, or were they in ordinary clothes?
No, it's uniform.
Uniform. Does it resemble any uniform you know?
I couldn't say. There's a couple of men behind me, and then his body, and he... There's a man on each side of him. And my eyes are open. My body's still asleep. He's watching and he's asleep. And thank you. And I begin to get mad. And they go, who the heck are these characters and what do they think they're doing? And so I turn around and I say, Bonnie, wake up. Bonnie, why don't you wake up? And he doesn't pay any attention. He keeps walking. And I keep going a little bit further and I turn around and I say his name again, Bonnie, wake up. And he doesn't pay any attention. And then the man who's walking beside me here says, oh, is his name Bonnie? And I turn around and I looked at this man and I figured it's none of his business. So I didn't speak to him. Did we keep walking? And I try to wake Bonnie up again. He said, Bonnie, Bonnie, wake up. And he doesn't. So the man said, he asked me again. He said, is Bonnie his name? Then I wouldn't ask him. So then he says, don't be afraid. You don't have any reason to be afraid. We're not going to harm you. But we just want to do some tests. And when the tests are over with, we'll take your body back and put you in your car. And you'll be on your way back home in no time. And so... I mean, he was sort of reassuring in a way, but I wasn't, can't say that I trusted what he said. And I wasn't sure what was going to happen, and we kept walking, and the body was still asleep, and then...
You mean he was walking in sleep?
Yeah, he was just like sleepwalking.
These men spoke good English?
Only one spoke, the one who was on my left. And he said, and then he would more or less. He had an accent. he has sort of a foreign accent. But he was very, you know, businesslike. So then we kept walking. We came to a clearing. And there were into the clearing, and there was I wish it was lighter so I could get a better picture of that. There was a ramp and a door. The object was on the ground.
The object was on the ground?
Yeah. I think it was the same one I was watching in the sky. And it was, there were trees, and there was a path, and there was this clearing. And this object just, the clearing I could see just about filled up this clearing. And they're taking me up to the object. Now, I don't want to go on it. I don't know what's going to happen if I go on it. I don't want to go. And I go up the ramp, and I go inside, and there's a corridor to the left. We go up the corridor, and there's a room, and they start to take me in the room. Some of the men come in the room with this man who speaks English and me. They stay for a minute. I don't know who they are. I guess maybe they're the crew. But they only stay for a minute. And the man who speaks English is there. And another man comes in. I haven't seen him before. I think he's a doctor. And they came in the door.
And I think he's got, I don't know how our nervous system is, but I hope that would never have nerve enough to go around kidnapping people right off the highways like he's done. And he tells me to take off my dress. And he told me to take off my dress, and then before I even have a chance hardly to stand up to do it, the examiner, my dress has a zipper down the back. And the examiner unzips my dress. It goes way down to my waist, the zipper does. And so I slip my dress off. And so I don't have my dress or my shoes on. And there's a next over away the stool, and then there's in the middle of the room is a table. Some kind of a table. It's not up very high, about the same height as a desk. So I lie down on the table on my back, and he brings over this how can I describe it? They're like needles. There's a whole cluster of needles. And each needle has a wire running from it. So then they roll me over
on my back. And the examiner has a long needle in his hand. And I see the needle. And it's bigger than any needle I've ever seen. I asked him what he's going to do with it. And he said, just a simple thing. And I asked him what. And he said he just wants to put it in my navel. It's just a simple test. And I tell him, no, it won't hurt. Don't do it. Don't do it. And he said, no, it won't hurt. And he said, the needle into my navel. And I'm crying and I tell him it's hurting and hurting and hurting, getting it out. And then the leader, he goes over and he puts his hand, runs his hand in front of my eyes. And he says, I'll be alright. I won't feel it. And all the pain goes away. Dad. Dad. But I still see the pain goes away, but I'm still sore from where they put that. I don't know why they put that long piece in my navel. I tried to tell them they shouldn't do it. But.
Did they make any sexual advances to you?
No.
They didn't.
No. I asked the leader, I said, why did they stick the needle in my navel? And he said it was a pregnancy test. And I said, well, I don't know what they expected, but that was no pregnancy test here. And he didn't say any more.
So, the examiner was helping. He helped me get up off the table, and I swung around, and he gave me my shoes, and I put those on and got down on the floor, and my dress was there, and I put my dress on, and I was going to zip it up, and he took a hold of the zipper at the top and pulled it up, and then, I said, I can go now, I can go back to the car, and he said, Bonnie isn't ready yet. And so then I began to get worried, and I asked him why it was taking so long with Bonnie. And he said, well, they were doing a few more tests with him, but he'd be right along in a minute. And, there was a cabinet there, and he had gone out of the room. There was just the leader and me there.
So there was a doctor there, you say?
And the man who did the examining, he did the testing, and he left. And so there was just the leader and me. And so I felt I mean, I was grateful to him because he had stopped my pain. And now I wasn't afraid at all. And so I started talking with the leader. And I said to him that this had been quite an experience. It was unbelievable that no one would ever believe me, and that most people didn't even know he was alive, and that what I needed was some proof that this had really happened. So he laughed, and he said, well, what kind of proof did I want? What would I like? And I said, well, if he could give me something to take back with me, then people would believe it. And so he told me to look around, and maybe I could find something I would like to take. And I did. And there wasn't much around. But on the cabinet, there was a book. A fairly big book. So I put my hand on the book and I said, could I have this? And the leader laughed, and he asked me if I thought I could read it. And I told him, no, I laughed too. I said, no. But I wasn't taking it to read, that this was going to be my proof that this had happened. That this is my proof. And so he said that I could have the book if I wanted it. And I picked it up, and I was delighted. I mean, this was more than I'd ever hoped for. He went over across the room to the head of the table, and there was, he did something. He opened up, it wasn't like a drawer. He sort of did something in the metal of the wall. There was an opening, and he pulled down a map. And he asked me, had I ever seen a map like this before? And I walked across the room, and I leaned against the table, and I looked at it. And it was a map of, it was an oblong map. And he said that the heavy lines were trade routes. And then the other lines, the solid lines, were places they went occasionally. And he said that the broken lines were expeditions. So I asked him where was his home port? And he said Where are you on this map? And I looked and I laughed and I said, I don't know. So he said, well then, if you don't know where you are, there wouldn't be any point of my telling you where I am. And he put the map, the map rolled up and he put it back in the space in the wall and closed it. And I felt very stupid because I didn't know where the earth was on the map. And I asked him, well, could he show me? Could he open up the map again and show me where the earth was? And he just laughed. And then I got the book. I still got the book. I'm carrying the book. I got it in my arms. It's a big book. And so I went back to the cabinet and put the book down and started to look through it again. And there was all of a sudden this noise out in the hall. And some of the other men come in, and with them is the examiner. And they're quite excited. So I asked the leader, I said, what's the matter? Did something happen to Barney? What is that? Well, it's something to do with Barney. And the examiner has me open my mouth. And he starts checking my teeth, and they're tugging at them. And I asked him, what are they trying to do?
What were they doing at them?
They were tugging my teeth.
Tugging at them, yes.
Yes. And the examiner said that he was very excited, and he said that, he said that they couldn't figure it out. Barney's teeth came out and mine didn't. And I was really laughing. And I said that Barney had dentures and I didn't, and that's why his teeth would come out. So then they asked me what were dentures. And I said that people, as they got older, lost their teeth. They had to go to the dentist and have their teeth extracted. And they put in dentures. Or a person, Barney had to have dentures because he had a mouth injury of some sort, and he had to have his teeth extracted. All these things you ask me, I don't know. I'm a very limited person trying to talk with you. But there are other people in this country who are not like me, that they would be most happy to talk with him. That they could answer all his questions. And maybe if he could come back, if we could make arrangements for a meeting, if he gave me time enough, somehow I could find these people. And I could arrange for him to meet them. And it would have to be done so there'd be no danger involved. I wouldn't want him to be exposed to any danger. That I don't know how I could do it. I don't know how I could. I'd work it out somehow. But if he could come, I want him to come back. I want him to. And he's just looking at me. And I, will you come back? Can we work out something? And then his questions would all have answers, and other people could get all the things I'd like to know too. And he says, I don't know. I don't know. It's not my decision to make. So I said, well, could you discuss it with the person who does have the decision to make? And he said, yes. And I said, well, if you do decide to come back, I mean, if it can be worked out, I would need time. It would take some time. I mean, I just couldn't go out on the spur of the moment and round up people to meet with you. It would have to be people that we knew would be all right and would have the background and all. And I wouldn't even know where to meet him. And he said, don't worry. If we decide to come back, we'll be able to find you all right. But I said, but I don't live around here. I don't live in this area. And he said, we'll find you. And I said, how? How will you find me? Out of millions of people. And he said, we will. We always do find those we want to. And I said, well, now what do you mean by that remark? And he just laughed. And then Barney's coming. They're bringing Barney out. I hear the men out in the corridor. And I said, Barney's coming. And he said, yes, you can go back to the car now. And I got the book. And Barney's coming out. And Barney's eyes are still shut. Good heavens. He's missed an awful lot. I wonder if he made him keep his eyes shut or if he's scared. So now it's time to go back to the car, and the leader said, come on, we'll walk back to the car with you. And I said, all right. I said, but I wish I knew if you were going to come back. And he said, well, we'll see. And we're out into the corridor. Barney's behind me with his eyes shut. There's a man on each side of him. And I'm all ready to go down the ramp when some of the other men, not the leader, but some of the other men are talking. I don't know what they're saying. But they're very excited. And the leader is saying, he's saying something. And they're undecided about something. And then, the leader comes over and takes my book. And I said, oh, I'm furious. I said, you promised me I could have the book. You gave me your word I could have it. And he said, I know it. he said, but the others object. They don't want you to have it. And I said, but this is my proof. If you take the book away from me, I'll have no proof that this has happened. And he said, that's the whole point. They don't want you to know it's happened. They want you to forget all about it. And that's why I'm taking the book. I won't forget about it. You can take the book, but you never, never, never can make me forget about it. Because I'll remember it was the last thing I ever do. But I want the book. He won't give it to me. And he says, he laughs. He said, maybe you will remember. I don't know. I hope you don't. But maybe you will. But it won't do you any good if you do. Because Barney won't. Barney won't remember one single thing. And not only that, if he should remember anything at all, he's going to remember it differently from you. And all you gotta do is get each other so confused you won't know what's going on. If you do remember, it'd be better if you forgot it anyway. But I said, why? Well, you try to threaten me? Because you can't scare me, because I won't forget it. I'll remember it somehow. So then he said, all right, now, come on, let's go back to the car. We'll go back to the, we'll take you back to the car. And, I've been standing there on the side of the ramp talking to him. And I'm not so mad now. And they've taken Barney ahead while we were talking. So the other men are going ahead. And he said, I had no objections to you having the book. But the others object. And they have as much right to make this decision as I do. So I said, all right, I won't be mad at you. But it is the most, I wish I could be able to have some proof of this, because it's the most unbelievable thing that's ever happened.
Betty woke up from her long session feeling drowsy, much as if she had been awakened from a normal night's sleep. She found herself looking around the office a little startled and was vaguely aware that she had been slightly upset. The question marks were obvious. How could two people describe similarly a complex phenomenon in detail, both in the conscious state and under deep hypnosis? How could they recount remarkably similar details of an abduction by humanoid, intelligent beings, which defied any encounter documented in history, when neither was aware of what the other had seen or reported under hypnosis to the doctor? Did this, or did this not, happen? By substantially ruling out lying and hallucinating, the doctor began to weigh the evidence of illusory elaboration, especially an examination of the dreams involved. After the first sessions with Barney, Dr. Simon began to assume that the illusions and fantasies were his, and that Betty had absorbed them from him. By the time of the next session, on March the 21st, 1964, the following Saturday morning, Dr. Simon planned to work on the theory that somehow Barney had absorbed and been influenced by Betty's dreams, and that Betty's dreams had developed into convictions that seemed real to her. By March 28, the following Saturday, the recall of what had been taking place in the sessions had increased progressively on the part of both Betty and Barney. Dr. Simon explored this aspect when the next session began. He planned to continue these interviews at a more conscious level. To both Barney and Betty, now that the doctor was permitting their revelations under hypnosis to filter back to consciousness, the strange experience became, in their eyes, a definite possibility. April 5, 1964, the day of the next session, found the Hills leaving Portsmouth at an earlier hour than usual. Prompting this was the possibility that they might be permitted to hear some of the playbacks of the tapes, the contents of which were, of course, a total mystery to both Betty and Barney. "When I first began hearing my voice under hypnosis," Barney later described it, "I was lifted out of my seat. I couldn't believe it. I knew it was my voice. But it was difficult for me to really understand that this was me saying that this had actually happened. It was as if I had been asleep and had talked in my sleep." Betty's reaction was similar. "I thought he sounded as though he were asleep. But then I began to get scared. I said to myself, 'Oh, good Lord, I'd just as soon go home and not hear them.' And then I began to wonder. Everything was building up to the part that I had heard all the way out in the waiting room when I heard Barney's outcries. I was anticipating that and wondered what my reaction would be." Slowly, the tape approached the portion involving Indian Head. "I knew I was getting to the point in which I had no complete memory," Barney continued in describing his reaction at a later date. "I felt quite secure being with the doctor in his office, and I had complete confidence in him. I knew that if the going got too rough, he could take me out of it. Then I was suddenly startled. When I put the binoculars up to my eyes, I couldn't believe I had reacted that way. And the eyes that seemed to come toward me. Then I heard myself saying that the eyes seemed to be burning into my senses like an indelible imprint. And I began in the doctor's office to feel the pieces unfolding. I was beginning to remember. Suddenly the lost pieces began coming together. Even while listening to the tapes, I felt this. I suddenly realized how I had broken my binocular straps, and I remembered that for days after Indian Head, I had an intense soreness in the back of my neck. Listening to the tapes, this came back to me sharply, the violent thrust of my arms breaking the binocular strap. All of this was unfolding, not just on the tapes, but beginning to unfold in my mind, my conscious mind. As the tapes went deeper and deeper into the part I had never remembered, there was the feeling as if heavy chains were being lifted off my shoulders. I felt that I need no longer suffer the anxieties of wondering what had happened. And then I thought of my shoes, the tops of them being scraped, literally scraped, that I noticed the day after Indian Head. How else would the tops of the shoes be scraped? And I was able to realize these men made me forget what happened. They told me to. They told me to forget, and I wanted to forget. And I think this is why it wasn't too difficult for me to put this whole thing out of my mind for so long. I knew, I felt, I was almost sure as I listened to the tapes that this was no fantasy or dream." Betty, in recalling her further reactions when they listened to the tapes for the first time, said, "When the tapes came to the part where Barney was standing there on the highway, I felt very sorry for him. I had a sort of feeling of being somewhat devastated. That why had we bothered, now that we had gone so far? What was the reason to find out about the whole thing? Let's forget hypnosis ever happened. Maybe we would have been better off just to leave things as they were. Maybe it was better just to wonder. And suddenly I became aware that all through this, I had never really stopped to think of what Barney's experiences were. His having separate experiences, alone. And listening to Barney's voice made me relive the incident, too. It was just like being right back out there on the highway." With frequent stops, the first tape was completed. Both Barney and Betty were somewhat stunned. In the elevator going down, they were alone for the first time with a measurable recall of the incident now thoroughly in their minds. The first thing that Betty could say was in reference to Dr. Simon. "I certainly," Betty laughed, "hope that Dr. Simon isn't really a spaceman." And again Barney said with the same whimsy, "Don't be ridiculous." Driving back to New Hampshire, Barney found himself rubbing the back of his neck, where in 1961 the burning sensation from the leather strap of the binoculars seemed to have inexplicably appeared and disappeared. His overall reaction to the tapes he summed up succinctly. I felt so overwhelmed and relieved. Now parts of my life that had been missing were added to it again. Parts of my life were being put back together. Continued playback of the recording stimulated release into the Hill's consciousness of further details, some which had not been expressed during the hypnotic sessions. Both Betty and Barney were overwhelmed by the massive details that came out in the recordings, much of it entirely unknown to them consciously. In a sense, among the principals, there were three points of view. Dr. Simon felt that from the available evidence from all sources and our present knowledge of mental functioning, he could accept the probability that the Hills had had an experience with an unusual aerial phenomenon, a sighting that stimulated an intense emotional experience for both of them. While anything is conceivable, he felt that the abduction was improbable. Betty felt that the hypnosis had demonstrated marked evidence that her dreams were a reflection and remembrance of reality. Barney vacillated between these points of view, although his ultimate conclusion was that he could not distinguish between other known reality and the sequence of events that finally came out under hypnosis. In other words, once the amnesia was overcome, he could sense no difference between what he remembered consciously and what he recalled under hypnosis. The entire journey had been a complete, uninterrupted continuum, including the abduction sequence. In the last three sessions, up to the final one on June the 27th, 1964, the three points of view frequently came out in the discussions. A healthy sign was that both Betty and Barney were less anxious after the recordings were played back. By June, everyone recognized that there would be no full conclusion, either to the therapy or the incident which played so big a part in it. Both the doctor and the Hills regretted that it would be impractical to continue into deeper therapy over the long period of time that would be necessary. At the place where the therapy was discontinued, the situation could rest with the minimum of danger. Short of acceptance of the whole experience as reality, which contradictory evidence prevented the doctor from doing, his best alternative lay in the dream hypothesis. Anything beyond that, the doctor commented later, would seem to stretch the limits of credulity too far. But I'm not absolutely convinced. I had to come to my conclusion, if you can call it a conclusion. It never really was one. Therapeutically, we had reached a good place to stop under the practical conditions existing and the Hill's basic improvement. It was acceptable, in my judgment, to leave it not fully answered. I knew that we would be remaining in contact and that perhaps time would bring a more complete answer. As the sessions drew to a close, the question of illusion or reality dominated the discussions. The doctor pointed out that he was not going to say it was either, that he and the Hills together would both have to grope for the truth, but that ultimately the acceptance or non-acceptance of the occurrence would have to rest with them. 6 full months of sessions were over. The Hills, puzzled but relieved, drove back to Portsmouth with the confused, vacant feeling that comes at the end of a long and arduous job, a feeling that they would miss the doctor, the sessions, and the search for a solution to a mystery that still remained unsolved. With the active treatment discontinued, Barney and Betty Hill settled down to their routine life, managing to put the incident at Indian Head into the background. They avoided any publicity about their experiences, and by confining their discussions on the subject to their close circle of friends, they avoided any problems. They had almost forgotten that back in September 1962, they had been invited to tell their experience informally to a UFO study group in Quincy, Massachusetts, some months before they had begun their therapy with Dr. Simon. They had been unaware that at that meeting a tape recording had been made of their talk. They were also unaware that this discussion later provided the basic information for the reporter who detailed the partial story in the series of articles in the Boston newspaper, appearing in the fall of 1965. Neither the Hills nor Dr. Simon had provided any direct information for this. The Hills were both depressed and frustrated by the articles. They had turned down a request for an interview by the reporter and made it clear to him that they were not interested in putting their experience on public display. The Hills' ultimate conclusion was, after considerable reflection, that a book should be written that would tell the story in complete detail, leaving it up to the reader to decide on its importance on the basis of the facts revealed. Philosophically, it has given me a broader appreciation of the universe. Barney Hill summed up his feelings. I tried to speculate on our own experience as to possibilities other than an extraterrestrial craft. I had to reach the conclusion that this theory was as valid as any other. The period before the amnesia hit us both is a matter of full reality to me, and to Betty, too. But just before the amnesia hit, I felt sure I saw persons of some kind aboard the craft. At that time, Betty did not. I felt this odd form of communication at that time. Betty didn't. This makes it a little difficult for me to accept the transference of Betty's dreams as an explanation. Although the problem with this whole story is that any explanation of it seems as difficult as another to accept. When Betty was telling her dreams to Walter Webb or to friends, I resisted the whole idea of her telling them because they seemed so absurd to me. Now, after listening to the recordings, I'm not so sure. I think the most important thing to me, Betty Hill summarized her feelings, is that I've taken a broader look at the world. Where are we going from here? And to look ahead at the future, you've got to know the past. When Dr. Simon first suggested the idea that maybe it could be possible that I had converted the dreams about the amnesia period into a false reality, I thought, well, this is wonderful. And so every night when I went to bed, I'd say to myself, it's only a dream. And I was able to do this for about 2 weeks, I guess, after the therapy was over. Then, all of a sudden one morning, I woke up with the thought, who do I think I'm trying to kid? Zoom, it was back again. And I haven't been successful in telling myself that it was a dream ever since. What interests me is that the incidents in my dreams and the incidents of the story that came out under hypnosis were almost identical. I don't feel that in this case, the interpretations of dream symbols can help determine whether our experience was real or not. And this is the part of the circumstance that is most important to us now that our anxieties are relieved. The Hills' story came to public attention with their extreme reluctance 5 years after the event, and only because of a leak that resulted in a series of local newspaper articles. The Hills sought no publicity and were successful in holding back the story for several years before it became public under their protests. Their views on the experience are the result of a long and painful period of intelligent examination and study, both in and out of therapy. Their approach to the subject has been rational and cautious. The greatest mystery about the experience is that any assumption on the basis of the material revealed is hard to conceive or understand. An abduction by humanoid intelligent beings from another planet in a spacecraft has always belonged to science fiction. To concoct a science fiction story of this magnitude would require an inconceivable skill and collaborative capacity. The assumption that Betty's dreams were absorbed by Barney to create his recollection of the abduction sequence is also hard to conceive or understand. If Betty's dreams had been the sole source of information about the humanoid beings, what about Barney's glimpse of persons aboard the craft recalled in full consciousness just before the beeping sound occurred? What about other portions of the apparent abduction that Barney recalled and Betty did not? How could the couple concoct the enormous amount of detail, strikingly similar, and stick to it so consistently? From the long and intensive exploration of the case, however, certain nearly irrefutable points emerge. 1. A sighting of some sort took place. 2. The object sighted appears to have been a craft. As perceived by the Hills, the craft was similar to many previously and since reported by others who have sighted unidentified flying objects. 3. The sighting caused a severe emotional reaction. Much of the direct emotional response was repressed and suppressed, attaining conscious expression in diffuse anxiety, dreams of nightmarish quality, and physical symptoms, until released and discharged during treatment. Some of the inner emotional experiences came to consciousness only under hypnosis. 4. The anxiety and apprehension engendered by Barney Hill's racial sensitivity served to intensify the emotional response to the sighting. Throughout the entire trip from Montreal to the sighting, Barney Hill suffered from increasing apprehension and fear of hostile reactions to his race, although none materialized. This oppressive feeling could sensitize him to any unusual or strange experience and intensify his reactions to such an experience. 5. The Hills had no ulterior motive to create such a story. They had confined their experience to a small group of people for 4 years. The Hills had kept their story restricted to a few intimates and to interested scientists and investigators. Treatment was sought for their emotional disturbances, and they decided to release their story only after it had been publicized without their permission 5 years after the incident. 6. The case was investigated by several technical and scientific persons who supported the possibility of the reality of the experience. 7. There is a measurable amount of direct physical circumstantial evidence to support the validity of the experience. No explanation has been found for the shiny bright spots on the trunk of the car, which caused the compass to oscillate, nor for the failure of the Hills' watches to run after the sighting experience. Barney Hill's broken binocular strap and sore neck could attest to his extreme agitation. 8. Under hypnosis by a qualified psychiatrist, both the Hills told almost identical stories of what had taken place during their period of amnesia. A dual identical psychosis, folie à deux, is substantially excluded by the absence of other characteristics of this rare psychosis, nor was there any other evidence of psychosis. A joint fabrication is also substantially excluded. The two remaining possibilities would appear to be, 1. A totally real and true experience. 2. An experience which had been so affected by the accompanying emotional state as to produce some perceptive and illusory misinterpretations, as embodied in the dream hypothesis. There are no final answers. But as Tennyson has said, maybe wildest dreams are but the needful preludes of the truth. The following is the recall of the end of one of Betty's dreams, which she wrote down as notes to herself after the incident had taken place. She wrote, "We left the ship and walked through the woods. This time it seemed like a very short time. I spent the time saying that I would always remember and asking that they return. Please, please return." The leader said it was not his decision to make. He did not know if he would come back. I said that I was very happy about meeting him and honored and thanked him for being kind. All the men accompanied us. We came to the car, and the leader suggested that we wait and see them leave. We agreed. Barney seemed to wake up as we approached the car, and he showed no emotion, as if this were an everyday occurrence. We stood on the right-hand side of the car. Barney was leaning against the front fender, and I was by the door. As we were waiting, I thought of Delcy. I opened the car door, and Delcy was under the front seat. She was trembling badly, and I patted her for a moment. She came out, and I picked her up and held her, again leaning against the car door. Suddenly, the ship became a bright, glowing object, and it appeared to roll like a ball turning over about 3 or 4 times, and then sailing into the sky. In a moment, it was gone, as though they had turned out the lights. I turned to Barney, and I was exuberant. I said that it was the most marvelous, most unbelievable experience of my whole life. I patted Delcy and said, "There they go, and we are none the worse for wear." We got in the car and Barney started driving. He said nothing during this whole experience, so I turned to him and asked, "Do you believe in flying saucers now?" He replied, "Don't be ridiculous." Then we heard the beeping on the car again, and I thought, "Good luck. Goodbye, and I am going to forget about you. If you want me to forget,